Okay, so we're going to go over these main points, right, and explain some of the key points in detail, and the others we'll just sort of touch on, right? And hopefully we'll have an opportunity for people to ask questions that have arisen during the course of their studying. So, as I've already told you, the exam format is 6 multiple choice questions. You'll be able to choose the 6 that you answer from a selection of 8. 4 short answer questions, which you'll answer in 6 lines or less. There are actually 6 lines printed on the exam. And you get to choose from a selection of 6. And then 2 essay questions that you choose from these 2 different sections, each one having 2 options. And as I was saying in response to the question over here, I'm sorry, I wish I knew everyone's name, but I don't. You should probably expect to spend about 45 minutes on each of the essays, and then the remaining 30 minutes on these faster, more straightforward questions, right? So, multiple choice questions have 5 options, just like the quizzes, and you should expect to use 3 to 5 sentences, depending on how much you want to say in answer to the short answer questions. There are situations in which 2 sentences would also be fine. It just depends on sentence structure and all that kind of stuff, right? So, we talked a little bit. I sent out an email before the midterm about writing essays, and then Professor Emanuel and Dr. Schmidt talked a little bit about writing essays as well. I'm just going to very, very quickly go over a couple of things having to do with writing essays again and talk about the key differences between writing an exam essay and writing a take-home essay, which is, of course, a much more sort of drawn-out process, right? So before you answer an exam essay question, write down an outline. At least this is what has always been successful for me. Other people might be able to sort of immediately think of what they're going to say and how it should be said and just go with it. But I find that your response is more structured and more clearly an answer to the question if you write down a little outline first. And your outline's going to say your answer to the question, so that's a thesis, a rough thesis, right? And then a few words about the key points that you're using to support your answer to the question, so to support your thesis. And then when you're writing out your answers, make sure you're not straying really far from your outline. It's so easy in an exam situation to start worrying about how much time you have, worrying about the next question, and sort of letting your mind wander a little bit so that you begin to write things that are irrelevant out of nervousness or distraction about other parts of the exam or things like that, right? And that's something that the outline system is really designed to help you avoid. If you're sticking to some notes that you made yourself about what you want to say, then you know you're not going too far astray, right? Write legibly, really important. If I can't read what you're saying, I can't give you credit for saying it. Some people don't remember that, and I really have had situations when grading exams in which I could not tell. I had no idea what the person was saying. And I really want to give you credit for the stuff that you're saying, so write it in a way that makes it possible for me to read it. So, like the take-home essays, your exam essays should be clear, they should be concise, and they should show that you know the course material, right? That means you should know who Mill is, you should know what the complete live system is, you should know who Rawls is and Kant and things like that, right? And also, like the take-home essays, you should be giving me some kind of clear thesis. That doesn't mean that it has to be beautifully articulate and it has to all fit in a certain amount of space or anything like this. You don't have to make it as polished as your take-home essay thesis. But it should just be a statement that tells me what you're going to say in answer to the question, right? A clear statement that tells me how you're answering this question. So again, like the take-home essays, you should be able to discuss theoretical positions that are relevant to the prompt and to your response to the question, right, to your thesis. Unlike the take-home essays, you don't need to cite article names or titles of works. You don't need to cite pages. You can refer in general terms to a kind of theoretical position without talking about the author of that position or how you learned about it. That's all fine, right? If you want to talk about fair innings, you don't have to give me an article title or tell me who came up with fair innings, for example, right? So I'm grading these essays based on the quality of your argument. Should be clear, and it should be a real response, a well-developed response to the question. It should be relevant. This goes back to the outline thing. Don't just spew out whatever you know that's related to the word, you know, Rawls, right? stick to your answer to the question. And again, written in readable handwriting so that I can give you credit for all the great stuff you're saying. So, again, thesis is a clear response to the topic. You're showing a good grasp of the relevant issues, and you know the general positions and really major authors, right? Kant, Mill, cost-effectiveness analysis, complete live system. These are things that should be easily and fluidly discussed in the course of your essays, depending on what the topic is. You don't want to put all those in one. Okay, so now to the actual content review. Right at the beginning of the course, we started by talking about what rationing is. So, what's the definition of rationing we're using in this class? Just anyone throw that out there. Yes?
Allocating beneficial medical resources and circumstances of absolute scarcity?
Yes.
I'm sorry, what
did you say? Everybody hear that? So, in situations of absolute scarcity, allocating medical resources, right? So rationing situations are situations in which there's some absolutely scarce medical resource, meaning there's a limited supply of it, and we need to get that limited supply to a number of people, but the people who need it, right, is much greater than the actual supply. So we talked about some examples in the very first week of class, insulin, which was very difficult to produce at the beginning, right? And so it had to be given to only a few people, only a small subset of diabetics who needed it. Penicillin, which was an extremely useful antibiotic, but there wasn't enough yet to give to everybody who could benefit from it. And dialysis, right, which was available to only a few at great cost. So we talked as well about rationing versus resource allocation versus priority setting. So if we return to that absolute scarcity point, right, rationing involves absolute scarcity. Resource allocation involves relative scarcity. So if we're talking about resource allocation, we're talking about things that are limited by, say, problems with distribution or problems of affordability, not problems of actual product, right? Lack of the thing. So liver is absolutely scarce. Even if everyone was an organ donor, we wouldn't have enough to satisfy the need. On the other hand, now something like dialysis is just expensive. We can give it to everybody who needs it if we have enough money, right? Now, priority setting can apply to both rationing and resource allocation. So priority setting is a matter of determining what our priorities are in allocating the resources we have, whether those resources are absolutely scarce or relatively scarce. So you could do rationing without priority setting or with priority setting, and you could do resource allocation without priority setting or with priority setting. Now, we're going to tend to think that priority setting helps, right? Knowing what our goals are in allocating these resources is going to help us do a better job. But it is possible to allocate resources without setting priorities. And that's kind of what happened, right? If we think back to the insulin case, it was really sort of scattershot. There were no real criteria that determined who was going to get insulin. It was sort of whoever showed up really, really sick at the door of the right person. So it is certainly possible to distribute rationed resources without priority setting, but it doesn't always give us the best or the most ethical results, right? So we also talked about disagreement about the term rationing and how it's used. Lots of different authors give us different definitions. some falling into what in this class is just called resource allocation, right? But the important thing to know for the final is that the definition of rationing for this class is the distribution or allocation of absolutely scarce resources, even though some other authors disagree, right? We also talked about how organs are allocated. We talked about multiple listing and about the values that are embodied by the UNOS policies. And unless someone has specific questions about that, I'll just flag that we talked about it and move on. Yes? No, you don't need to know, you know, the text of their policies and then what values those embody. But what I would do if I were reviewing for the final is look back at what the policy is and ask myself, what values do the different policies or priorities that they have embody? Because what you do want to be able to do is look at a policy and know when you look at it, oh, that embodies this kind of value. It doesn't embody that kind of value. So you don't need to memorize their system and the values that it embodies, but you do want to be able to recognize what kinds of values different priorities or different systems are embodying when you're given that information, right? Anything else about this stuff? Okay. So, this is again from the very beginning of class. Everybody did pretty well on the quiz question about this chart. So I just want to remind you of it, remind you that it gives you some information about different definitions of rationing that different authors use. But again, I want to emphasize that what you want to know is that for this class, rationing is about absolutely scarce resources, right? But does everybody feel like they've got a good sense of this little chart? Yes.
So just to check my room, so necessary is for rationing and the beneficial ones are for research ones? I don't really remember the necessary resolution.
Okay, so if something's necessary, then you really need it, right? Whereas if it's beneficial, you could still live without it. So you really need a liver, for example, right? A healthy diet might be beneficial, but you could still live without it. Great. So, again, absolutely scarce, that's going to be the kind of thing that's rationed according to the definition for this class, right? Not absolutely scarce, maybe some other people will call some of these not absolutely scarce things rationed things, but we don't in this class. And the necessary things are, again, the things that you absolutely need. So you're talking about livers or treatments that people are going to die without, right? Things like that. Whereas beneficial things are just good or improve quality of life. So explicitly rationed things, again, organs, things like that. Non-explicitly rationed things are things that we don't know exactly how they're being allocated. We don't know necessarily the criteria that are being used to allocate them, things like that. So rationing for the purposes of this class is going to fall right here. Oh, here, on the top, right? And one over here is the key category for the first half of this class, right? For the kinds of things that people absolutely need, and there aren't enough of them to go around, and so we have to determine how to distribute them. Sorry, I'm always really distracted by that. Is that outside or in here? Okay, it stopped. So, looking to a specific example, dialysis, right? When it first came around, there weren't enough dialysis machines for everybody. One in 50 people who needed dialysis were getting dialysis. Clearly a case of rationing, right? There just isn't enough of this stuff, isn't enough of this technology to help everyone who needs it. So the key ethical issues at stake were, you know, what determines who gets this thing that not everybody can have, this life-saving treatment that not everybody can have. There are limited solutions available to prevent people from needing dialysis, right? They can try to live healthier lifestyles. Sometimes that's going to be an effective strategy, sometimes not, depending on the person. And clearly this is a tragic choice. No matter what we do, someone's not going to get treatment and someone's going to die, right? And they solved this problem by coming up with committees who selected the people who were going to get dialysis. Over time, dialysis became more available, more widely available, right? It changed from a problem of absolute scarcity to a problem of relative scarcity, in which dialysis became a treatment that people could get, but it was really expensive, right? So the question shifted from who among the people who need treatment should have access to it to how do we make it so that people who need this treatment can afford it, right? So rather than who should receive treatment, the question is there an entitlement to coverage for this treatment, or how do we help people to pay for this treatment? Questions like that, right? And there might be better fixes available. Rather than just people trying to live healthier lives, we can look for ways to reduce the cost of the treatment, or we can look for ways to divert funding to programs that assist people in paying for the treatment, right? So we also introduced at the very beginning these three levels of analysis. The micro level, which was the kind of level that we focused on in the first part of the class, right? Physicians and patients interacting and making choices about how treatment would be allocated. The meso level, which might happen with a hospital or a healthcare organization. So, for example, we talked about a hospital that chose not to cover a new, very expensive chemotherapy drug that didn't appear to be more beneficial than existing choices, right? So that's a choice made at the meso level. And then the macro level, which is a choice made by the government. So we moved on then to talk about theories or approaches that can give us guidance in how to set priorities, both for rationing and for resource allocation. So the first theory we talked about was consequentialism, and I put utilitarianism there in parentheses because although utilitarianism is just one type of consequentialism, it's the most important type and the type that we talked about in this class. So on the final exam, you don't really need to use the word consequentialism. You can just say utilitarianism, even though it's only one type of consequentialism. Also, if you just say consequentialism and you don't say utilitarianism, I'll assume you're talking about utilitarianism. So no need to go on about the fine distinctions there. So according to consequentialism, it's the consequences, the results, or the effects of our actions and of events not caused by us that make a moral difference, that matter ethically. So since it's the results, the situations that happen because of what we did or because of natural disasters or happenstance or whatever, it's the results of activity that matters, we should try to produce good results, right? So results are important, then what we want are good results, good situations that will result from our actions. It's less important how we get to those good situations, and it's more important that they exist. So the key figure here was Mill. Remember, Mill says we should focus it on increasing happiness as much as possible, increasing pleasure as much as possible, and decreasing pain and unhappiness as much as possible. The method by which we get there is less important than getting to that place where we have maximal happiness, maximal welfare, or maximal pleasure, right? Yeah.
Would you say that the morality is based on the foreseeable results, or does it, like, let's say, you know, afterwards, there's a foreseeable result that's negative?
That's a really good question. So, did everybody hear the question? So basically the idea is, what's most important here? Is it that we actually get this good result, or is it that we're aiming for this good result, right? So have we still done the right thing if there's some unintended consequence and something that we thought would produce great results actually produces poor results? The answer from the consequentialist perspective is, since the consequences are bad, turns out your action was bad. Maybe you couldn't know that. Maybe we shouldn't hold you responsible. But in fact, your action was bad. So if you really had good intentions, suppose I see someone drowning, I try to save them. I fail, I also drown. Seems like my intentions were really good, right? But actually, I did the wrong thing because the current was really strong, I'm a horrible swimmer, and the results weren't what I was going for. So we're not going to blame me, hopefully. right? We're going to feel bad for me. I hope. So we'll feel bad for someone if they die trying to do something nice, but we'll also think, you know, if they had assessed the situation better, or if they were better at recognizing the flow of the river, right, the currents in the river, then they would have seen that this was the wrong choice. Even in situations where I couldn't possibly have known that my choice was wrong, it still turns out that what I did was wrong, right? Even if there was no way for me to know, I thought I was a great swimmer and I was just mistaken, then still what I did was wrong. We're not going to penalize me, but it's still wrong. So we talked then about deontology. The key figure for deontology is Kant. And you can just say Kantian. You don't need to use these big words like deontology if you don't want to. So according to deontology, it's respect for duty and preservation of the good that matters. And if you remember the Kant reading, the only absolutely good thing is a good will. So we want to preserve that good will. Pleasure, contra utilitarianism or consequentialism, right? So utilitarianism, consequentialism is going to say pleasure and happiness are the ultimate goods that we're going for, whatever methods we use to get there. Deontology or Kantianism is going to say, no, pleasure can be good or bad. The pleasure that a sadistic person takes in hurting another person or an animal is wrong and bad. Pleasure isn't an absolutely good thing. Happiness isn't an absolutely good thing. Instead, what we should be going for is having respect for the good and maintenance of the right values and intentions. That means respecting oneself as an autonomous being with a free will and with moral worth. And it means respecting other people as autonomous beings with a free will and with moral worth. So a completely different approach, right? And Kant is going to say we could still praise the person who drowned for doing the right thing, right? He or she really thought that this person was savable and was trying to exercise the duty of assisting those in need. Right? And even though it didn't work out, we can still say that this person did something valuable. So a very different approach. Lastly, we talked about political liberalism, Rawls' view. So this is a political theory, clearly, and it says that political organization should be structured around principles and resource allocations that everyone in society can affirm, right? Anyone in society can agree with. The mechanisms for determining what these principles and distributions are the original position and reflective equilibrium. So is everyone comfortable with the original position and reflective equilibrium, or should we talk about that more?
Can you talk about reflective equilibrium?
Okay, so the original position, I'll just say one sentence about that. A hypothetical choice situation in which people who don't really know anything about their personalities or their life goals get together, right? And they try to decide what kinds of principles for political organization are the right ones. So that's the original position. Rawls thinks because people don't know about their own specific selves, their goals, their life plans, they're going to look for principles that would be appropriate for people with any life plan, any goal, right? That would be fair to all people, goals, social status, people of any social status, and so on, right? So that's the original position. Reflective equilibrium is a method by which we try to choose principles that affirm lots of different values. So we might have lots of different goals and values and beliefs that we take to be important, right? So maybe I think helping people who are doing poorly is really important, right? And maybe I think treating people equally is important. Maybe I also think having my basic needs met is important, right? My basic health needs met is important. So I have lots of different values. I also might think, like utilitarians, right, that maximizing good results or producing more happiness is really important, while I also agree with Kant that it's important to have the right intentions and to respect other people when I'm acting. So reflective equilibrium is a process that tries to justify all of these beliefs, right? So suppose take the example of agreeing with Kant that intentions are really important, and agreeing with Mill that results are really important. How do I come up with a position that's consistent but respects both of those perspectives, right? Well, the process of reflective equilibrium involves thinking about how I might pursue those goals in different contexts, how I might try to come up with a system that manages to encompass both, things like that, right? So it's a process by which I think through the values and beliefs that are important to me and try to come up with some kind of consistent system that incorporates what's most important about all of them. Yeah?
So where does the veil of ignorance come in then? Is that part of the original position?
That is part of the original position. So the question was, where does the veil of ignorance come in? And that is part of the original position. The parties or people who are part of the original position, they don't know anything about themselves, right? So like I said, they don't know their social station, how much money they have, what their life goals are. That's all part of the veil of ignorance. The veil of ignorance is just their lack of knowledge about who they are. Any more questions about these three figures? So Mill, Kant, Rawls. Yes. Okay, we're going to get there. I believe that is the next slide. Yes. So great question. So Rawls's political liberalism has two key principles. And the Emmanuel reading identifies the second principle as two different principles. So that reading is going to call these three principles. If you say three principles, that's okay. I tend to go for two principles because that's what Rawls himself gives us, right? So Rawls calls them two principles and says that the second one just has two parts. Emmanuel says, no, these are three. These are really three different principles. So you can say either one, but I do favor myself saying two principles because it's Rawls's theory and that's what he wanted to say. So the first principle says each person has the same indefeasible claim to a fully adequate scheme of equal basic liberties. And that scheme must be compatible with the same scheme of liberties for everybody, right? So I can't have more liberties than other people because I have more resources, right? I don't get more freedom of speech because I have more money. I mean, this might in fact be the case, but if we were under a Rawlsian system, it would not be the case. The second principle says that social and economic inequalities have to satisfy two different conditions. They need to be attached to offices and positions that are open to all under conditions of fair equality of opportunity, and we talked a lot in the class about what equality of opportunity is as opposed to equality of goods, right? Second, they have to be to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged members of society, and that's what the difference principle is. So the difference principle says that inequalities in society need to be to the benefit of the least advantaged people within society. So that means we could have inequality in society as long as that inequality makes things better for the people who are at the bottom, who are the worst off. So Professor Emmanuel a few weeks ago talked about this in connection to tiered systems of healthcare, and there was a quiz question about this too. So, if you remember the quiz question, it was, what kind of argument would Rawls give in support of tiering, right? So, why might Rawls think that tiering is okay, keeping in mind what the difference principle says? Okay, let me try. Oh yeah.
Justice and liberty.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's justice and liberty because the people have liberty to spend their own money, and it's also justice that to the society to provide the equality to access.
Exactly. So the idea is people should be able to pursue whatever health coverage they want, right? If it's consistent with their life plans, as long as they also have basic coverage, right? Why might the difference principle support this? Is that what you were going to tell me?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so on that point, if the alternative is that the poor have no coverage, then having basic coverage in a system that also allows certain people to have even better coverage is acceptable.
Yeah, so if we have a system in which some people are able to purchase extra coverage for themselves, we might in fact be benefiting the worst off, right? So if there are people paying for these really expensive services and expensive drugs, they can be putting money into the healthcare system that actually could benefit the worst off, right? So it could be that a tiered system is helpful to the worst off by sustaining healthcare systems, by encouraging innovation. Right at the beginning, it might be the case that some new experimental treatment that hasn't been proven effective, right? Suppose we have something like this. Only rich people are paying for it because it hasn't been proven effective, so we don't think of it as part of basic care, right? It might be the case that rich people paying for this experimental coverage can help us over time determine whether it's really valuable for care, right? Whether it should count as perhaps an essential benefit in the future. So it could be that a tiered system might actually be to the benefit of the worst off. That said, a tiered system could also be terrible for the worst off, right? We could have a tiered system where the bottom tier doesn't include all of the healthcare services that people need, doesn't include a lot of the basic services. And that kind of tiered system, clearly Rawls is going to reject. Yeah?
So when you compare it, though, do you compare it to the current system or to the other options?
When you compare,
if you're comparing different, you know, policy, different ways of providing coverage,
yeah,
you know, insurance coverage,
yeah,
you could say that it helps the worst off in comparison to the current system.
Oh,
but maybe,
okay.
Like, I'm just not sure if you compare it to the to what we have now versus what our different options. Policy options are for change.
Right. Okay. So the idea is: is the baseline that we're comparing a tiered system to the one we have now, or is it all of the possible systems that we could have? Right.
That we're actively considering. Yeah.
That we're actively considering. That's a good question. I mean. This isn't something that Rawls is really trying to address, actually.
Because that was my confusion.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. I mean, I would tend to think that we're comparing it to the baseline, right, to what's going on right now. As opposed to alternative policy options. But I think it's going to depend on whether the alternative policy options also meet the difference principle. Right.
Well, and also, because doesn't he order them? Aren't they his principles in order of importance?
Yes. So this one has to be met before this one, and this one has to be met before this one.
Right. So if a higher one achieves, if the another option achieves the higher level one, maybe it would trump.
Oh. Well, any of them will have to meet these, right? Anything that meets the difference principle has to meet these first. So he'll reject outright any system that sort of agrees with this. It's to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged and disagrees with this. So suppose we have a tiered system that doesn't give everybody the same basic level of liberty. Then he's going to say no. Even though it meets this, it doesn't meet this, and the principles are in order of importance, right? But suppose we have like four policy options, right? And one is better than what we have now. Another one is to greater benefit of the worst off, right? Then only one is going to really meet the difference principle, because it says to the greatest benefit, right? So only the policy option with the greatest benefit is going to meet this, because greatest is in there. Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, but that would make me think that wasn't the right answer, but that's fine.
But the quiz question, only one of those could possibly have been the right answer. Right? So the question of whether we're comparing it to baseline or to other possible options doesn't change what the answer to the quiz should have been, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. We then talked about the complete live system, which considers four key values and the principles that follow from those values. So the key values were promoting equality, and again, back to Rawls, that means equality of opportunity, not equality in terms of amount of goods, right? So it doesn't mean we all have the same amount of stuff or the same amount of healthcare resources. It means we have the equal ability to choose for ourselves what kind of coverage we want, right? So the complete live system is going to be consistent with tiering, just like Rawls's system is. Okay, as long as everyone has the basics again. So promote equality, help the worst off, which is also called prioritarianism. And again, this embodies something very Rawlsian, the difference principle, right? So advantaging people who are currently the worst off. Maximizing benefits, that's consistent with, say, utilitarianism or consequentialism. You're looking for good outcomes, which is exactly what the consequentialist is going for. And promoting and rewarding social usefulness. And this includes the backward-looking value of reciprocity, rewarding people for what they've done that's good for society, as well as the forward-looking value of instrumental value, right? So what people can do for us and our society going forward. So instrumental value is going to include things like prioritizing vaccination for doctors in an influenza epidemic, say, whereas a reciprocity issue would be giving treatment to someone because of the great contribution that they've made to social or intellectual life, right? So reciprocity looks to the things that people have accomplished, whereas instrumental value looks to the things that they're going to be able to do for society going forward. So the complete live system considered each of these four values and considered principles that fall under these values. So these are the four values and the principles that fall under them. This is probably stuff you know pretty much backwards and forwards by now, I'm guessing, because you've heard a lot about the complete live system. So unless people want to focus more on this, I'll go through it pretty fast. These were the values considered, the principles falling under them that were considered, and some were rejected as being not important, right, or flawed in a fundamental way. So none of the values alone, even the good ones, certainly not the flawed ones, is sufficient to produce a good healthcare system, right? Each one of the values has both problems and virtues, and some of the principles falling under the values just have no value at all, no usefulness at all. So how do we accommodate the fact that none of these values is sufficient in and of itself? We come up with a multi-principle system. So it's going to incorporate multiple values and multiple principles that fall under the values in order to create something that can be sufficient to tell us what sort of healthcare allocation we should go for. Yes?
Can you explain, like, the difference between a value and a principle?
Yes. So if we go back to this slide, and this slide is very, very similar to a slide from week 5, if you want to review this stuff. So a value is something more basic than a principle. So these four values are basic things that we might take to be important. Equality, right? It's a basic thing, not really reducible to something else that seems important to us. And then the principles that fall under them are different ways of expressing or getting at these values. So equality is important to us. One way of trying to realize equality in the healthcare context is through lottery, by randomly assigning who's going to get treatment or who's going to get the placebo in a trial, something like that. Another way to try and realize equality is this principle of first come, first serve. So the idea is whoever it is that shows up first has the first chance to get treatment. We're treating everybody equally because anyone who comes through our door, if they're the first one, they get treatment. Of course, the authors of the Complete Lives System say only one of these principles actually does a good job of realizing the value of equality. So they're both things that try to realize that value. That's what makes them principles. They both try to realize this important value that's not reducible to something else. But only one actually succeeds in doing that, lottery. Whereas first come, first served might look like it promotes equality, but really it doesn't, because certain people have easier access to treatment and are able to be first for reasons that are unfair or unequal. Again, with helping the worst off, that's a basic value that we can't really reduce to something else. But there are different ways of realizing it depending on who we think the worst off is. So if we think the worst off are the sickest, then we might favor sickest first. If we think the worst off are youngest because they've had the fewest life years, then we might favor helping youngest first rather than helping sickest first. So values are basic things, not reducible to something else, that we take to be important, and principles are different ways of realizing those values. So a system that's multi-principle in nature tries to balance different kinds of considerations in a way that creates a sufficient healthcare system. And the authors of the Complete Lives System contend none of these values alone is going to be sufficient, right? So the focus is on, for the authors of the Complete Lives System, giving a complete life to as many people as possible. So we use different values, different things that we take to be fundamentally important, to try and create a system that gives as many people as possible a complete life. This system tries to balance the values and the principles falling under them that are most important. So of the three theoretical positions, what is that most reminiscent of? Kant, Rawls, Mill. Who seems to get the most emphasis under Complete Lives? Yeah. Rawls, yeah. So why Rawls?
Because it attempts to balance rather than presupposing one overarching moral theory that's always right.
Yeah, exactly. So if we think back to reflective equilibrium that we just talked about, what's the goal there? Try and reconcile lots of different things that we take to be important. That's exactly what they're doing with the Complete Life System. So Rawls says, yeah, we might have utilitarian leanings that tell us good outcomes are really important, happiness is really important, feeling pleasure is really important. But we might also think that's not the only really important thing, that intentions are also important. How do we try to reconcile those different intuitions? Through the process of reflective equilibrium, trying to balance the different intuitions against one another and look for a system that can consistently incorporate all of them. That's exactly what the Complete Lives System is trying to do here. It's looking at these different values that we take to be fundamentally important and trying to find a way to reconcile all of them. And the authors of the Complete Lives System say, well, how do we best balance these four really important values by, and this is why it's in bold, trying to give as many people as possible a complete life, right? So yeah, Rawls is definitely the emphasis here. So, the principles that contain important and morally relevant considerations should be part of this multi-principle system, and we should try to balance them against one another. Those principles, you probably know, are lottery, youngest first, number of lives saved, prognosis, and in parentheses, instrumental value. Why is it in parentheses? Because it only matters in emergency situations. So in everyday circumstances, I'm not going to give someone treatment just because he's a really great guy who does a lot for society, or because he's a doctor and someone else isn't. But if we're in an epidemic situation and this doctor is someone who can help patients who are extremely sick, we're going to want to prioritize treatment for him so that he can help other people, right? So again, the values included remain the same, for same form, fundamental values, but the authors of the Complete Lives System conclude that some of the principles falling under those values don't really succeed in realizing the fundamental values, and so they get rid of those principles. So, how do we allocate kidneys and livers? By blood type, waiting list time, and mortality risk score. So again, back to the question that was asked earlier, you don't need to memorize a lot of information about the allocation systems for different organs or anything like that, but you want to have a sense of what kinds of values are expressed by different ways of allocating. So why is blood type important? This should be straightforward. Yeah, right? If we don't bother to match the blood type for an organ recipient, probably the recipient's not going to do that great, right? So prognosis is the relevant principle here. We want people to survive and use the absolutely scarce organs that we're giving them. Waiting list time. What's the operative principle? First come, first served. So obviously the authors of the Complete Lives System would suggest a change to the allocation guidelines, right? To the UNOS allocation guidelines. Because they claim this first come, first served principle doesn't really realize the value of equality. It just appears to. Finally, mortality risk score. That's sickest first, right? Because the people who are at the most advanced stage of disease have priority over others. Again, this emphasizes a principle that the authors of the Complete Lives System think doesn't really embody the fundamental values that we have, right? So it looks like it helps the worst off, but really it doesn't embody the value of helping the worst off, because we should be focusing on getting as many people complete lives as possible, and sickest first doesn't help us do that. So these guidelines, these organ allocation guidelines, emphasize some of the principles that the Complete Lives System claims are least defensible, right? So they're going to suggest pretty substantial changes to the organ allocation system. Okay. We then moved on to pandemic situations from organ situations. So, like organs, vaccines, antiviral drugs, ICU beds, and respirators are absolutely scarce. So that's what makes this a rationing situation, right? If we had plenty of these things and the problem was just that it's really expensive to put everybody on them in a pandemic situation, then it would be a resource allocation problem, not a rationing problem. But we just don't have enough ICU beds, respirators, vaccines, and so on to accommodate everyone who would get sick in a pandemic, and so this really is a rationing situation. So we talked a lot about the influenza plan from 2005 and the guidelines that provided some revision to that in 2008. These were both meant to address the question of how available resources should be rationed in these pandemic situations. So because of limited supply, limited production capacity, we need to explicitly ration flu vaccine. And the 2005 plan considers most important these four values that I've listed, so risk of complication, likelihood of benefit from vaccination, role as a responder, so that would favor prioritizing people who produce vaccine or people who are intimately involved in the healthcare system, And finally, maintenance of critical infrastructure. So that would favor vaccinating people first who are maybe firefighters or who maintain the electrical grid. But they deem 14 values to be important, even though these four are the ones that they put at the top, right? Which Professor Emanuel, you may remember, said some critical things about, because it's really difficult to realize 14 values or balance 14 values at once. So I did stick this up here, but I'm not going to talk about it very much, just the different tiers for vaccine allocation. You don't have to have memorized the information in this chart here, but you should have a sense of what the priorities were in the initial proposal and in the 2008 revisions. Have a sense of, first of all, what are the values that they took to be most important? So you can see these four here, right? So what are the values that they took to be most important? And then how do they realize those values? By favoring specific groups in the different tiers. So you don't have to know everybody that's in all the tiers, but you do want to have a sense of who's in the tiers and what reasons they're there, right? So that said, I'm going to quickly skip through this. These slides will be online, so if you want to review this, you can take a look at them there. In 2008, the values are pretty much the same, but they do make some emphasis changes, right? And again, I'm going to sort of leap through those. So what would the complete live system say about the influenza preparedness system? Complete live system would propose that enabling more people to live a complete life is more important than minimizing number of deaths. So they're going to disagree with the 2005 plan, right? Okay. So the complete live system would give priority to people who can live through all stages of life. So this is going to support some kind of youngest first principle. Not a straightforward one, but some kind of youngest first principle. It's also going to give priority to healthier people with two or fewer high-risk conditions, right? Because they're more likely to recover and go on to be people who will live complete lives. Finally, the complete live system is going to give priority, lower priority, pardon me, to people who have more than two of these conditions, right? Because it's going to be a lot harder for these people to recover and live complete lives. So the complete live system says we should make an effort to maintain equality by perhaps incorporating a lottery within the different tiers, right? So people in the same tier or the same sub-tier might be prioritized by birth date lottery rather than by first come, first served. Because again, complete live system views first come, first served as a flawed principle for realizing equality, right? So they might suggest an alternate mechanism for guaranteeing equality within the different tiers. And finally, in these pandemic situations, the complete live system is going to recognize instrumental value by suggesting that we should maintain public order and maintain basic services, as well as maintaining the healthcare system, right? Because, of course, healthcare infrastructure is critical in a pandemic situation. So we then went back to the discussion of dialysis. So why did we talk about dialysis twice in the class? Yeah, so because in the first week when we talked about it, we were talking about absolute scarcity. And dialysis used to be an absolutely scarce resource. There were only a few dialysis machines. We couldn't give access to them to everybody who needed them. Later on, dialysis became a different kind of problem, a resource allocation problem, right? So we talked about it in the second half of the course because it was later a problem in which people could get access to a dialysis machine if they had a lot of money, and otherwise they couldn't. So by 1971, about 4,000 people were being kept alive by dialysis, but costs were very, very high for thousands of other people with end-stage renal disease. Right? So did a rationing problem still exist in 1971? No, exactly. It was a resource allocation problem at this point. So the problem was solved through Medicare funding of dialysis. And you don't need to know these numbers or these percentages. This is just to give you a clear sense of how the nature of the problem changed. So what's important to know for the final is what happened here. What kind of problem was dialysis at the beginning as opposed to what kind of problem it is now, right? Now, the problem with dialysis isn't that people can't get it because we've even covered it, right? So first it was a rationing problem. We didn't have enough machines for everybody. Then it became a resource allocation problem. Not everybody could afford to get on a machine. And now the problem is, wow, this treatment is really expensive and it's drawing a lot of resources away from other important programs. So it remains a problem of resource allocation, but costs are so high, right, that there might be questions about how dialysis has been covered since the 70s, right? Since this program was instituted to guarantee coverage for everyone who needs dialysis. So this dialysis case is a really nice representation of how the focus of the course shifted, right? First, we were talking about these situations of a very clear, explicit rationing where there was an absolutely scarce resource, wasn't enough to go around, and physicians involved in giving the treatment were deciding what to do. So that's the micro level again. We then switched to talking about the kinds of criteria that should count in different organizations, right? So UNOS rules, rules for particular hospitals, rules for particular insurance coverage agencies or companies, things like that, right? That's the meso level. And then we started talking finally about the macro level, in which there are laws, regulations, government policies that affect how people are covered and whether they get treatment. So, again, I know I'm hitting this point really hard, but it's really important to know. A key difference between rationing and resource allocation is that rationing takes place within intervention prioritizations, resource allocation across intervention prioritizations. So what does that mean? If you look back at this, what's the government choosing between? It's not choosing between patients who receive treatment for dialysis, right? It's choosing between whether we cover dialysis or we cover insulin for diabetics who need to inject, right? So it's dealing with questions of what kinds of fundamentally different interventions are most important, most fundamental, most need to be covered by agencies or by governments, not with questions like who should get this particular treatment among the people who want or need it, right? So this is just something from what week was this? I think this is week 7. Just a little chart telling you some different priorities that the government is going to need to consider, right? So unlike a question such as who's going to be eligible among people who want it to get a particular surgery, we're looking at what do we cover? What's most important? Prostate cancer surgery in 70-year-old males, behavioral depression therapy, right, or any of these other things. So fundamentally different kinds of treatments for fundamentally different kinds of conditions, but the government is really forced by the limited resources that it has to choose how to prioritize them. So governments and other responsible bodies have to find ways to compare really diverse interventions, and this is what leads many governments and agencies to use cost-effectiveness analysis with QALYs. And cost-effectiveness analysis with QALYs was a big focus of the second half of the course. So, what's the difference between this and cost-benefit analysis? There was a quiz question about this as well. Yes?
Cost-benefit converts to dollars, while cost-effectiveness looks at health outcomes?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead. There's plenty to be said about it. So I saw some other people with hands up too. This is exactly right. right? So what is cost benefit analysis talk about? Dollars. Everything's in dollars. So benefits have to be measured in dollars for cost benefit analysis. Costs also measured in dollars, of course. What about cost effectiveness analysis? How are benefits measured in cost effectiveness analysis? Not in dollars. Yeah, so qualies or dollies or life years or kinds of measures that you can't really put in monetary terms. So cost effectiveness analysis is a lot more prominent, partly because people don't really like the idea of converting seemingly intangible things like life years to dollar amounts, right? So cost effectiveness analysis considers the change in cost divided by the change in benefit. This gives us a cost effectiveness ratio that tells us how much a treatment is going to cost for the benefit it provides, and we can use that cost effectiveness ratio to compare it to totally different kinds of treatments, right? So it's this kind of thing that enables us to, say, compare tooth caps to appendectomies, right? So cost effectiveness analysis involves taking the net change in cost and dividing it by the net change in benefit. Again, this was a quiz question. Most people did pretty well on this quiz question, but since so much of the second half of the course talked about cost effectiveness analysis, I do want to just remind everyone of it. So, again, net change in cost over net change in benefit. So first we're going to talk about net change in cost. How do we calculate cost for a particular intervention? We add up doctor's fees, drugs, equipment, but we have to do more than that too. We also have to think about how a particular intervention might save us money in the future, right? So if we're looking at an intervention like bed nets for malaria, we're not just going to think about the cost right now. We're going to think about the savings later from not having to treat people with malaria, right? That all has to be reflected in this first part of the equation, right? So costs don't include loss of economic productivity. This was a quiz question as well. And I was kind of surprised by how many people missed this quiz question. So what does include loss of economic productivity?
Dollies.
So dollies consider productivity losses. Cost effectiveness analysis with qualies doesn't, because the quali, and we'll talk about this in a minute, the quali isn't about how much productivity I've lost. It's just about, as the name would suggest, it's just about the quality of the life that I've got, the quality of the life years. It's not about how me being disabled, so think disabled, Dolly, right? It's not about how my being disabled is going to affect society or other people. Dollies, on the other hand, do take that into account. They do take into account how my disability might be a problem for society as a whole, relative to maybe the disability of someone else who does something more useful than philosophy. So, something to keep in mind. So the net change in benefit, on the other hand, factors in positive health benefits as well as the harmful side effects of an intervention, right? So when we're calculating the benefit of one intervention over another, we don't just look alone at the life years that are going to be gained by a given intervention. We also look at the quality of those life years. And again, that's very much in the spirit of analysis using qualies, right? So qualies incorporate how good my life is. Because of that, cost effectiveness analysis using qualies is factoring in both the ways that this intervention is going to affect my life positively and the ways that it's going to affect my life negatively. So it might improve my quality of life by curing some disease I have, but it might also reduce my quality of life by making me nauseated all the time, say, right? So the net change in benefit is going to be different for a medication that makes me feel fine, right? I'm fully recovered and I feel fine, versus a medication that cures my disease but makes me feel really nauseated. I'm going to have a lower quality with that second medication, right? So an analysis that's measured in terms of qualies is going to be taking that into account. So importantly, in cost effectiveness analysis, the starting points and ending points don't impact the value of the net change in cost or benefit. What does that mean? That means the difference between two interventions that are $25 and $35 or $30 is the same as the difference between interventions that are $50,025 and $50,030. Why? Because the net change is the same, $5. So cost effectiveness analysis is only telling us what the net change is. It's not going to tell us anything more than that. Either way, we saved $5, right? Or spent $5, depending on how you look at this. So, again, similarly, a change in a quality of 0.2 to a quality of 0.3 is going to be the same in terms of cost-effectiveness analysis as a change from a quality of 0.8 to a quality of 0.9. So the benefit of a treatment, say, that raises somebody's quality of life from a 0.2 to a 0.3 level is viewed as equally beneficial to a change, an intervention that creates a change from 0.8 to 0.9. Some people think this might be a problem, right? Because the people at 0.8 are doing a lot better than the people at 0.2, and cost-effectiveness analysis alone doesn't consider that. We might need to supplement it with something else or replace it with something else in order to capture the fact that some interventions are going to help people who are really badly off, while others are going to help people who are already doing pretty well, right? So this leads us to some of the problems with cost-effectiveness analysis, right? We're measuring cost-effectiveness analysis with natural units like life years, survival rate, or change after treatment. So, or we're measuring it with composite units like qualies and dollies. Really, the most common method is with these composite units, qualies and dollies. So we're not going to ask you to talk about cost-effectiveness analysis using any of these other things, right? Any of these natural units. That's not going to be a problem that you'll have to think about on the final. But it is something you should know, that you could do cost-effectiveness analysis with these other kinds of units, even though the most common way to do it is with the composite units, quality and dolly, right? So, with that in mind, since this is the most prominent way to do cost-effectiveness analysis, we'll talk about cost-effectiveness analysis using qualies. What's a quali? It's a means to compare the benefit of all of these different kinds of treatments, right? A means to compare the relative benefit of, say, setting a leg that's broken, capping a tooth, treating a terminal cancer, all of these different things. It's supposed to do that in a straightforward way by giving us a scale for quality of life from 1 to 0, right? It's a composite unit that just looks at how a life year can be modified in terms of its quality. So a really important question for cost-effectiveness analysis using qualies is whether we can really determine a numerical value for quality of life. And we talked a lot about whether this was possible and the possible complications of doing it. So we also discussed how it might be possible to determine this numerical value, right? How do we determine the extent to which my life is made worse, the extent to which the quality of my life is lowered by different diseases, illnesses, problems, right, or disabilities. So we talked about two common methods for that. You don't need to talk about either of those methods on the final. You just have to have a clear sense of what the quali is, right? So it's this composite unit that modifies a life year in terms of its quality. You have to have a sense of that. You also want to have a sense of why that might be a good or bad measure, right? Why might it be good or bad to have this kind of composite unit that takes everybody's life years and tries to compare them in terms of how good they are. So, which philosopher is going to be most likely to support cost-effectiveness analysis using qualies? I don't think this was a quiz question, but it was a clicker question, and people did really well on it. But it's worth emphasizing.
Yeah.
Yes. So everybody heard that? Yeah. So why?
Yeah. The outcome.
Yeah, exactly. So cost-effectiveness analysis using qualies looks at outcomes, just like utilitarianism looks at outcomes. How do we maximize the quality life years that we get out of using a particular intervention? That's what cost-effectiveness analysis focuses on, and of course we know that's what Mill focuses on. Less Kant and Rawls, who are looking at how we get there a lot more closely. So, how is Rawls, then, with this in mind, going to look at cost-effectiveness analysis? Clearly, it doesn't direct resources to people who are the worst off, right? It doesn't direct resources to people who start off with lower health quality. As we just said a minute ago, there's no difference between someone going from a 0.2 to 0.3 quality of life years and someone going from a 0.7 to a 0.8 or a 0.8 to a 0.9 quality of life years. So cost-effectiveness analysis alone doesn't give us any prioritarian measure, right? It doesn't tell us how we can benefit people who are doing the worst. There's no inherent mechanism for sickest first, youngest first, worst off, etc. So, relatedly, there are some concerns about how qualities could be biased against disabled people. So of the philosophers we talked about, who's going to be most concerned about these issues, do you think? Okay, so Kant and Rawls are going to be worried about this, right? Why might Rawls be worried about this?
Difference principle?
Yeah, so we just talked about this just now, right? There's no clear mechanism for helping the worst off. So there's no clear mechanism for following the difference principle. What about Kant? Yeah?
I think he would say it violates the principle of equality, you know, treating people equally and people who are worst off, I think he would argue.
Okay, so Kant thinks we need to treat people equally because they have equal moral worth, right? We all are autonomous beings with a free will and with equal moral worth. If that's true, then disabled people presumably are going to be people who have equal moral worth. And it seems like qualies, for reasons that Dan Brock talked about when he visited the class and that I've summarized here, qualies could discriminate against those people who are viewed by both Kant and Rawls as equally valuable, right? So I'm not going to go much into the specifics of why qualies could be discriminatory. I did put it on here so that if you want to review it later, you can look at these slides. You can also look at the slides from the cost-effectiveness analysis week. Professor Brock's slides are up, and they can give you a lot more detail, obviously, about these issues than I can in a review session. So just to drive home the central point, the core problem is using people's undeserved disadvantage, right? Undeserved disadvantage due to disability to disadvantage them even more. So they're people with equal moral worth, people who deserve equal treatment, and they're disadvantaged at the get-go, right? Because they're given a lower quality even at baseline. Then when they get sick, their quality is reduced even more, right? So if they start out, if someone is blind, say, and they have a quality of 0.71, I think it is, for blindness. And then they get, say, cancer, they're going to be at a major disadvantage as opposed to someone who's not blind and then gets cancer, right? And this is what Professor Brock called the core problem, right? Using disadvantage to disadvantage these people even more. So, we now move on to the most missed quiz question ever. let's just talk about this chart. People didn't like this chart, apparently. How would we fill in the chart? I'm glad I didn't give this quiz again today. so, what? First of all, let's look at what these things are, right? The countries, you know what those are already. what about cost effectiveness thresholds? What are those?
Great Britain considers cost effective.
Definitely, right? So, Great Britain has a cost effectiveness threshold, but what is a cost effectiveness threshold? Yeah.
It's a line that's drawn about the cost effectiveness of a particular intervention over which an intervention will be rejected and under which it will be accepted for use in public.
Yeah, so cost effectiveness threshold is a strict cutoff based on cost effectiveness analysis using qualies, right? So cost effectiveness analysis using qualies, we just talked about that. A cost-effectiveness threshold takes a certain cost-effectiveness ratio, rushing back to that right here, right? So a threshold takes a certain cost-effectiveness ratio, and it says if this intervention is less cost-effective, then we don't cover it as an institution or a government or whatever, right? So this kind of threshold is a strict cutoff that says if something's less cost effectiveness than X, we don't cover it. So, with that in mind, which of these countries has it? Somebody already said Great Britain. Any others? Sound of silence. It's good here because no, none of the other ones have it. Why might Australia be confusing though?
It uses qualies, but it also has reference pricing.
Yeah, so they use qualies, but they don't have a strict threshold. So still, the right thing to do here would be to leave it blank, right? And only check Great Britain. But a number of people wrote something in about that, or they put a check mark and an X, or things like this, right, to suggest that the Australia case is a little bit more complicated, that they do use cost-effectiveness analysis with qualies, they just don't have one of these thresholds. So as an answer, I accepted both an explanation of that issue and a blank box. Germany, on the other hand, very clear, very easy case, right? They don't use cost-effectiveness analysis with qualies, and they don't have a threshold. How about rule of rescue? So what is the rule of rescue? Yeah?
If no other treatments are proven to be effective, then they'll still support you just trying something.
Yeah, so suppose you're really sick, right? You're about to die. You've tried all of the conventional treatments already, and you want to try a treatment that hasn't been proven effective yet. Is the government going to support you in that?
In Germany,
the answer is yes, right? So we had the case of the sick little boy who wanted to try a treatment that was not only not yet proven effective, but pretty clearly bunk, right? It pretty clearly does nothing. Still, the government said, we'll support that because the patient has tried everything else and they want to give this thing a go. In the kind of case that we talked about in class, there's really only a psychological benefit here, right? It's because it's really been proven not to be effective. But in some cases, that's not going to be true, right? There are lots of cases in which there might be a treatment that's promising or it looks like it might be beneficial, but we just don't know yet. And rule of rescue is going to cover those cases too. So we know that Germany has it in a really extreme form. They have it even for things that are basically proven not to work. What about Australia and Great Britain? Okay, how about Great Britain?
No.
How about Australia?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So, not so bad. There's no chart on the final, though, just so you know. Don't feel scared, no chart. But you should still have a sense of how these different countries handle these issues differently. And that's why I went ahead and put this up for the review. You do want to have a sense of what the priorities are in these countries, but you're not going to need to fill out any comparisons or charts. Okay. This was the is this the same quiz? I think this is the same quiz, right? Yeah. This is the same quiz. So this was the overall lowest scoring quiz. That's why I'm putting the other questions on here too. I gave a lot of zeros on this quiz, which I can't think of any zero I gave for any other quiz. And then on this quiz, I gave out a few of them. So for most of you, this quiz will be dropped, but all the more reason to review the information, right? So after consultation with citizens' councils, NICE decided not to give weight to which of these things? Not to give weight. So age, vulnerable populations, rare conditions or orphan diseases, behavior-dependent conditions, or social class. Yes. So what does that mean? That means NICE does give weight to things like vulnerable populations, behavior-dependent conditions, and so on. They just don't give weight to this one thing. Among the following countries, which has co-payments?
Wait, C.
Wait, now I'm asking myself that question.
To not accept.
This is painfully worded.
Yeah.
It's painfully worded. B. Now I want to say B. I'm going to look it up for you because if I'm wrong, I'll feel really bad. So, among these, which has co-payments or co-insurance linked to the effectiveness of a treatment? Only France. Only France has this. So I think this is slide 9 from the week on lessons from other countries. It's a nice little chart on that slide telling you how co-payments work in different countries. And France is the only one that gives different percentages of coverage based on how effective a drug is at solving a particular problem or treating a certain condition.
But isn't that also reference groups?
Reference groups, didn't we talk about this in office hours, or was that somebody else?
Not me.
Okay. No, reference groups are different because those look at something not in terms of the product available to a consumer, right, and how much they're paying for it. So the groups assess the value of a treatment, not relative to how it's going to do on the market or how much we're going to charge for it in the sort of final you're buying this thing at the pharmacy terms, right? But in broader terms. So the only country that actually has payers getting their prescriptions who pay different percentages depending on how many or how effective the treatment is, the only country that does that is France.
So the more effective, the less it costs.
So if the treatment is more effective, you're going to be paying a lower percentage out of pocket. It might still cost more if it's a seriously effective treatment, but it's really expensive, but your percentage is going to be lower. Okay, leaving that painful quiz behind. This is almost directly from one of Harold's final slides in the Lessons from Other Countries week. And it's really useful, I think, as a summary of how different countries approach these issues. So if you want to go back over this, I would look at these final slides because they give you the kind of overall sense that you need of how these different countries approach these issues. And that's really, that's what you need to know for the final. You don't need to know lots of specifics about that complicated efficiency frontier chart or anything like that, right? What you do need to know is how are different countries prioritizing care and coverage and why? So you do want to have a sense of that. I'm going to have to go really soon because I need to be somewhere at 7 and it takes me about half an hour to get there. But I do want to, I'm almost done with this presentation, and I want you to bear with me as I go quickly, and keep in mind that you can always review these slides online. So, quickly, tiering, what is it? If society guarantees essential healthcare services, can people spend their own money to get additional healthcare services? We touched on this earlier. It's just important to know what tiering is and why you might like it or dislike it. So why might you dislike tiering? One argument is that medical need should be the only criterion for distributing healthcare. We just shouldn't be thinking about cost. We should be thinking about who needs particular interventions the most and why. If we do that, then it's pretty hard to tier, right? Because tiering involves looking at the costs of different treatments inherently, right? So patients' medical needs are the only relevant basis for determining access to care, those who argue against tiering say. And it would be fundamentally unethical to provide differential access based on how much money you have, right? So it would be fundamentally wrong to have different coverage based just on how much money you've got. We should only think about medical need. That's the argument against tiering. So I'll go back to this slide. What about arguments for tiering? We talked about this a little bit too. So from collective resources, people should be guaranteed essential healthcare services only. So they shouldn't be guaranteed any healthcare services. They should be guaranteed only the essential ones, only the ones that we really need in order to pursue our goals, our ends, and so on. From private resources, people should be free to buy the sort of healthcare that they want. So a single-tiered system is actually less ethical than a multi-tier system because it violates people's ability to choose coverage that matches their goals or their priorities or their life plans. It means that some people are going to be worse off and no one's better off. So everyone has the same coverage and no one's better off. Now, why might we think this is the case? Going back to the Lockean proviso. Locke says people should be able to exercise their liberty as long as much and as good is left for others. So in his view, you can take whatever you want as long as you don't take enough that you're depriving other people of opportunities. And the fundamental disagreement between these two positions is really a question of whether tiering leaves as much and as good for others. So people who argue against tiering say, look, rich people who can afford to buy really good coverage, they're going to take medical resources away from poor people who don't have that kind of money, who can't afford to buy that really good coverage. They're not leaving as much and as good for other people. People in favor of tiering say that's just false. Tiering leaves as much and as good for other people because people can still get basic healthcare services or essential healthcare services while the wealthy are spending extra money on extra services or coverage. So people who are in favor of tiering, if we go back to the next slide, are going to say, look, suppose my life plan supports lots of skydiving. I'm really into skydiving. I love it. And I want to buy extra coverage that will take care of accidents arising from my skydiving. That's the kind of thing that we'd think isn't, you know, almost anyone's going to say, right, this isn't an essential healthcare benefit. Nobody has to go skydiving. It's really not one of the basics. So some coverage that will take care of me when I'm horribly injured during my recreational activities shouldn't be part of the basics. But if I'm wealthy and I'm into these kinds of risky activities and I want to buy that coverage, it doesn't hurt anyone else. People against tiering say, actually, that does hurt somebody else because you could be drawing resources away from people who need basic services by going in and getting taken care of when you have a skydiving accident. So is that distinction clear? People who are for tiering say, look, tiering is just about people with more money paying for the kinds of extra services or extra coverage for risk that they want. Maybe I'm really into looking young and healthy, and so I want something that covers cosmetic procedures. That's clearly not an essential benefit, but I'm not taking anything away from other people by getting coverage for that. On the other hand, if I'm against tiering, I'm going to say, actually, that can hurt other people, because when I go and I have various procedures done or I have complications from those procedures, it hurts other people's access to care. So the fundamental disagreement is really about the Lockean proviso. Does tiering really leave as much in as good for others or not? So again, about tiering, this is a quiz question. People did pretty well on this quiz question, but I put it up here just because it gets you to think about what the philosophical issues around tiering are. So we've really already covered this earlier tonight, but which of the following would be one of Rawls's arguments in favor of tiering? So the correct answer is B. People should have the liberty to utilize their own resources to purchase additional healthcare services above the basics if that helps them to realize their life plans. So that's exactly the kind of argument in favor of tiering that's outlined on this slide, right? That I can, if it's consistent with my life plan or my goals, spend extra money on coverage for, say, risky things that I do or procedures that I want that other people don't really feel the need for, like, say, massage therapy or cosmetic procedures or stress relief herbs or, you know, whatever kinds of extra things that are considered non-essential but that some people really want to pay for. So, finally, I want to spend just a moment on personal responsibility for care. Wellness incentives are increasingly common. Harold talked about this a lot in lecture. The rationales largely center around promoting health, controlling costs, and improving employee productivity. And I should say, Dr. Schmidt argued that often a rationale implicitly is maintaining or promoting certain values and morals that society likes, right? But someone like the head of Safeway, who spent a lot of time lobbying for these wellness incentives, really de-emphasizes that, right? So he focuses a lot on health promotion, cost control, productivity gains, things like this, because most people don't want to sound like they're just being moralistic. But Dr. Schmidt argues, right, that this is a kind of implicit motivation for a lot of these policies. So the concept of personal responsibility, some claim, is wrong-headed, arbitrary, disingenuous, and even dangerous. So obviously this is a pretty bold claim, and one that fundamentally rejects the kinds of considerations we were talking about here, right? Fundamentally rejects the idea that wellness incentives can be good for health, good for cost control, and good for productivity. So the concern here is there could be people who are considered risk takers, right, or unwell, and therefore de-incentivized by these systems. There could be plenty of these people whose conditions are not the fault of their own motivations or of their own choices. There might also be people who are simply more susceptible to making bad choices for reasons that are not their fault, right? For reasons related to their experience or the conditions around them. So there could be causal responsibility. So for example, I might have overeaten and become obese. That's causal responsibility, right? Without there being fault or accountability. This might have happened because as a child I was fed really unhealthy foods, and I've been obese for a long time. Or it might be the result of certain genetic factors that would cause me to gain weight even when someone else eating similar foods didn't gain weight, right? So there might be a causal reason for me to be heavier than others without there being fault or accountability on my part. In addition, people who argue against these wellness incentives say, well, there are plenty of other risk takers, right? So there are people who go out and do skydiving. That's probably not covered by most insurance policies. But there are things that people do, like, say, bicycling. So I'm from a coastal area with a lot of really, really curvy roads over, you know, 100-foot cliffs that fall to the ocean. And I see bicyclists out there all the time, biking up these hills, just waiting to be hit by cars. And these people are going to be covered, even though they're engaging in risky behavior, right? They're doing things that other people who are part of their employee plan, right, their health plan, those other people are going to have to pay for. And yet they are not de-incentivized by wellness incentives. In fact, these incentives might promote their incredibly reckless bicycling by saying that biking is something we reward as a healthy activity, right? So there are plenty of other risk takers who are not penalized, even while we are penalizing certain people, right? Further, there are concerns about freedom of the will, but we're not going to talk about that on the final, so you can go home and think about it on your own time. So thanks for coming. Do let me know. Let me know if you have other questions, because it's really late. We all want to go, and you might still want to ask me some things. I have an email address. You probably know what it is. And you can also meet me on Tuesday. I know that's the day before the final, but it is the soonest that I can meet you. So let me know.